principals and sending out to the schools your expectations on what this budget should reasonably be expected to buy. And I think if you do that, that will really improve the conversation between the legislature and the school community. So I really hope you do that, and then expect to hear back from them next time about how it went, and for another round of budgeting.
And so during this upcoming interim, you're going to take on higher ed?
Like, well, I'd love to. That's another bill which we'd love to talk with you about.
Right. Well, you certainly have done well on K through 12.
Thank you.
So thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
And, Gene, why don't we get started? Randall Edwards was scheduled to be here at 1:30. And if you, I know you don't mind being interrupted by high-placed elected officials.
I can deal with it.
You're used to that.
I'm used to that. Yes, yeah. Definitely used to that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jean Thorne. I'm the Governor's Education and Workforce Policy Advisor. And today what we'd like to talk with you about, you've now had the background of kind of where we've been in funding around K-12, even over the past decade, and the changes that we've seen. In moving from a system that is basically a local system where the local taxpayers made decisions about funding for their schools, and they could see what was to occur in that schools, what did occur in those schools, to a system where now the state is responsible, primarily responsible for not only funding but setting the overall statewide figure, which includes the property taxes. So even though the state money is 70% of it, in essence, the state, except for a little bit of local option money, controls how much money the local school districts will have. And as we've moved to that, I think that all of you who have either been here, two of you have been here a long time, have been here a shorter time, have dealt with the frustrations of how do you pick a number? How do we figure out what the number should be for K-12 when we do have a fund? And that fund, because the distribution mechanisms and where schools were before Measure 5 certainly affects schools in different ways. And trying to bring a picture to that and understanding of what a number, various numbers may mean, I'm sure has been frustrating for all of you. Now that we have the quality education model, we had the initial model come out kind of towards the end of last session, and I think a lot of people talked about it was a good start, but we really need to understand, was this a solid model upon which to make some decisions? We've done that now in the interim. I think the Quality Education Commission, as I noted yesterday, has really done a wonderful job. There were, I sat through all the meetings and tried not to speak, but that lasted till about the second meeting. And there were lively discussions, and I think the having business, private sector, and educators on that, it was a very good mix where people questioned. It was not a more money for education crowd. It was really a group of people who came together to try to figure out how could we build a model that would allow us to reasonably estimate what the cost should be of meeting the educational goals that were set in statute. Kind of my background in the Oregon Health Plan and the governor's background in the Oregon Health Plan, you talk about what do you want, how much does it cost, and can we afford it? And in the Education Act for the 21st century that was passed in 1991 and then amended in 1995, the legislature established what it is we want. What is it as policymakers we want from the schools in this state? And now we're finally dealing with what does it cost, and then can we afford it? So this time, I think our budget process is one that having the tools of the quality education model and having the requirements of Measure 1 really put us in a very different position of building a budget that would have meaning to it. And so before I see anything, I see that the treasurer has arrived. Right. So
if you will interrupt you from
I will move aside and come back.
Welcome, Randall.
First time the governor stepped in there.
Well, this is the first time you've been here as the state treasurer.
That's right.
So is that a clue of why she did it? Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. And the reason we started, you're 3 minutes late.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for correcting my time.
Yeah. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. It is a pleasure to be on this side of the dais and to be the state treasurer of Oregon, and appreciate this opportunity to talk about what I think is still one of the biggest financial challenges facing the state, and that's adequately funding our public schools. And I am here both as a parent. I have two young children in public schools in Portland, and I have a third that will be in it in about 2 years. So I have a personal interest in what we do today, what this committee's looking at, and into the future. And I'm also here as a state treasurer because I do believe this is an issue that affects all of us in all of our capacities as a state elected official in my capacity as a state financial officer. Investing in our schools and our children is an enormous challenge, and there are no easy answers, and I think all of us recognize that. It is clear we need to build on this budget and to use the Oregon Quality Education Model, which I guess is being presented to you, and using that model as the roadmap as we go forward. Over the past year, I have traveled all over the state and have looked and talked with people about their school situation, whether that's in Baker City, Corvallis, Newport, Coos Bay, Redmond, Hillsboro, the list goes on and on. And school districts, the message is clear, and it's continuing, and that is that they're struggling to provide quality education to their children. And there are lots of reasons for that, and it's not unique to any one part of the state. It's a global issue. It could be declining enrollment, and that applies to both large and small school districts. Or you'd be on the other extreme. You have fast-growing school districts where they can't keep up with the fast pace of enrollment. You have changing demographics, and I think the Oregonian really highlighted the changes that are happening here over the last 10 years, and those changes will continue about meeting children who have language needs to help encourage and help them have a positive educational experience. Something that I've been working on in this session with a number of others is the capital needs of schools, that there are incredible disparities in school districts, in the facilities themselves, again, whether that's building new buildings, helping provide safe environment. In fact, I think there's legislation to try to, again, help the seismic issue of schools throughout the state. Teachers and administrators are working hard to help us meet the act that we put out early in the last decade, the Educational Act of the 21st Century. But to be successful in that endeavor, we need to make sure that they have the resources. So what's different about the budget before you today? And I think this is a hallmark budget. And that is the governor has done something I don't think any other governor in the State of the Union has done, and quite frankly, is he should be given a lot of credit for beginning the process of using the quality education model, the outlines of that model, to begin to budget what we need as a state for resources. This is the first time we have begun to link resources to performance, and I think we can't underscore or emphasize enough the novelty of that idea. And again, with this committee's blessing and going forward, embracing that is going to be a pivotal point as we debate long-term how we address the school funding needs of Oregon. I was part of the initial speaker's QEM, if you want to use that acronym, in 1997, began to see the intricacies of this model and how it really can help all of you begin to address the long-term needs of the state. And again, the governor, what he's done in his budget, as you know, has begun to take a portion of the funding and front-load it into some strategic areas that we all know and the model demonstrated will begin to provide outcomes, and that is an early intervention with reading, again, trying to get us towards benchmarks in the early grades and to move us more quickly. And I think that's a very laudable thing. While we have the model and we're using that and we have $5.2 billion before you, and again, I'm here to encourage you to support that number as a minimum. It is still that. It is a minimum, and there are many stories to be told around the state regarding how this budget is still inadequate, and that isn't to say you're not in a tough position, but the fact is many school districts, and I know there are folks from the Coalition for School Funding Now who are here in the building today and will be here tomorrow if they have an opportunity to talk to you about what is going on in their school district. And I think it's important for them to tell their story, because there are stories that are consistent throughout Oregon about what is happening in their school districts that we all need to hear. So where do we go from here? And I think this is really the crux of my whole presentation, which is we need to look at this as the beginning point of a long journey. And I'm, as state treasurer, I'm committed to working with you and any other member of the elected body to look at the long term, because at the end of the day, we are going to need to use the model and drive the debate with the public about what is adequate funding for our schools so that all children now and into the future have an opportunity to succeed. And I think that's what we all want. We know where we want to go. We have the tool now to begin that debate and to embrace that. I think if you look at what the quality education model did and said, was that we should be spending about another $1 billion on schools this biennium. I'm here to tell you that's probably not quite true, because that's assuming we were at the model's level of funding with schools. That is, we had smaller schools, we have smaller class sizes, for example, we had longer school years. The transition cost to that, whether that's the capital side, just getting to that point, there's a greater cost than that. The point is we have a ways to go, and I'm committed as state treasurer to make this a reality for all of us in the state, to work with you, the policymakers, and the governor, the next governor, to make sure that we have those resources and to look at the long term, because at the end, that's what we need to be doing, looking at the long term. You've got a great start here. The governor's put a good first step forward with the quality education model, and I'm here to support anything you can do to keep building on that. So, be happy to answer any questions. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about this. Say it from the heart as a parent, but also as a statewide elected official.
Right. Randall, thank you very much, and I know you did play an important role in the QEM, and we worked on other things in the legislature, and you're going to be an important resource for us as we try to develop a budget within our resources, of course, but it's really great to have you part of a member of the team, so to speak. Other questions or comments for Senator Tro?
Randall, is it going to be possible to have some good idea of the cost of the schools for the next biennium in time, so that when all those initiatives come out that cost the state lots and lots of money, that we can say, but look, you know, we've got to fund schools, and it's going to take so much, and we've got to fund the rest of the budget, it's going to take so much, so we can't really afford these initiatives.
I think that's the challenge before us, is to begin to refine the model. Maybe you can't do it all at once. I guess that's kind of the point. Yeah. There are things in there, I think, there are people who are much more versed on educational theory than I am. There may be pieces that you would say, these are the elements that we want to go for first, whatever that may be, that will give us the most bang for the buck. I mean, the governor really did start that by saying, let's front load this, let's put some money early on. It isn't to neglect those already in the system, but you got to start somewhere. Early intervention obviously is a place to begin, and then to start to price that and tell the public, well, here are your choices. If you go down this route with a certain measure, we won't be able to do this. And you can start to frame that debate, what you're saying, Senator, to really take to the public what is needed. Yeah. And I think this, again,
it'd be very useful from that standpoint.
What is always so apparent to me, and having sat on that side of the dais, when you look at the situation and it's just pure numbers, and we're spending, in fact, the model, even at $6 billion, if you were to spend that today, that's just what we were spending in 1992, 93. So we really haven't been making those long-term investments on a per capita basis, and it's catching up to us. And that's the point. And so therefore, we got to take this debate and look longer term. We have a model. There's been some great work done on that. And to continue to work with that as the framework to the public and say, what do we want? How are we going to get there? And what is it going to cost us to get there? And this is the beginning point today.
That's good. Thank you. Thank you very much, Randall.
Thank you very much.
I will invite you back here in about 2 weeks after
Great.
We get the hay forecast.
Thank you very much.
Your thoughts on that.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Good. Gene Thorne, please come back.
Thank you. Was pointed out to me, I neglect, yesterday you met four members of the Quality Education Commission, and a fifth member is actually here today, George Russell, superintendent of Eugene School District, and George was a great contributor to the work, and appreciate all the time and effort he put into it as well. What I'd like to do then today is cover the requirements under ballot measure 1, which was passed last November, because there are new requirements on state policymakers around, I guess I would say, accountability for the decisions, the funding decisions related to schools, how the governor's budget does use the quality education model, the governor's findings under measure 1, because you'll see measure 1 does require a reporting out, and talk about how this budget then would link in with schools, and have a brief discussion around the school improvement fund, School Improvement Fund is House Bill 2298, and that's up for a work session in House Education tomorrow and has a subsequent referral to this committee. So it does, you have the appropriation side of the School Improvement Fund, so I'll talk briefly about the how that program would be structured. And then Kate Dixon from the Department of Education will talk about the A word. How do we then tie this to accountability? We've talked about accountability for policymakers around the decision making of and setting the expectations on in relationship to the budget. And how does the accountability system work, and how would schools then be linked into that? Measure one had two components, one of which dealt with establishing some equalization grants for property for school districts that passed a local option. But the part of Measure One that most people know about relates to sufficiency of funding. And really, design, as you know, the governor and Stan Bunn and Ron Tempe from Standard Insurance were the chief petitioners on Measure One, really to try to change the debate on school funding so that we had a more direct linkage. As I said a few moments ago, we've talked about, we have in statute what it is we expect schools to do, but now to link the cost with that and have a more explicit discussion about the expectations for schools and the cost of doing that, the budget decisions and that are ultimately made, and then how that in turn goes back and affects the expectations. So it requires that the legislature should appropriate money sufficient to ensure that the state system of public education meets quality goals established by law. Well, it doesn't stop there, and publish a report that either demonstrates the appropriation is sufficient, or, if it's not sufficient, identifies the reasons for the insufficiency, the extent of the insufficiency, and the impact on the ability of the state system of public education to meet those quality goals. And the work of the Quality Education Commission, as you'll see, as we move through this today, allows us to answer those questions. And so I think you also have before you a Measure One report from the governor, which I'll refer to later. The governor's budget, then, in terms of using the quality education model, again, is to try to provide meaning to the budget. I think, as Representative Schrader noted yesterday, of trying to understand what should we expect for the amount of money that is put into schools, or conversely, if we expect schools to do something, how much does that cost? And to try again from not having 198 separate budgets and having a school fund to arrive at some reasonable conclusions about that. So the governor's budget uses the quality education model to focus on outcomes. What is it that we expect schools to do? We have, I think, the last several sessions, you know, money is appropriated to schools, and schools are told, go out, continue to do what you're doing, but do it even better. And that's about the level of performance expectations that we're able to tie to the budget. The quality education model is then used. There's a phase-in to reflect the commission's priorities. Again, the focus on outcomes, using the components of the prototype schools and their statewide costs. And I'll show you how the governor did that in his budget. As you also know, there's a reallocation, I'll get to that also, that is necessary in this budget. So the quality ed model, you can use it to go both ways. You can look at taking money away or moving money away. What might the impacts of that be? And lastly, the governor then used the quality ed model to establish performance expectations for the total amount that was budgeted. So not looking only at third and fifth grade, but eighth grade and tenth grade as well. As you heard the commissioners speak yesterday, they said that the phase-in emphasis that was recommended by the commission was to get 90% of third and fifth graders to meet or exceed the reading benchmarks within 4 years, and that would be 2004 or 2005. I think I have it written down here somewhere. I always get off a little bit. The commission did that, I think, for a couple of reasons. From the research that they did, you've got to read to learn, and having that early focus on reading is very critical to future learning. Also, the education leadership team, which was formed through legislation passed last time, which included the governor, the House Speaker, the President of the Senate, the Superintendent of Public Instruction, the Chancellor of Higher Ed, the Community College Commissioner, the Commissioner of Bureau of Labor and Industries, and 14 other members had identified early reading as being a key goal for our state's K-16, pre-K-20, even if you want to say, system. At the same time, this emphasis on early reading fit in, resonated very well with the governor, because just as Representative Winters mentioned yesterday, the P word, to really have children who do well later in life, we need to not just start focusing when they come into kindergarten or into pre-kindergarten, but actually from the time of pre-birth and to move on. And so as part of the Oregon Children's Plan, there is additional money that he's recommending as part to enhance our pre-kindergarten program as well as the upfront screening and triage and referral to support services. So this really, having this emphasis on early reading, really was seen as a continuum of the Oregon Children's Plan effort as well. So if that's what our goals are, 90% of third and fifth graders to meet or exceed the reading benchmarks, then how do we use the quality ed model to determine what's the reasonable amount of money that we might need in this state to reach those goals? So we focused then on the prototype elementary school. What were the components of the prototype elementary schools that would most likely lead to these outcomes? Knowing that, again, I think if you remember yesterday, the total additional cost of funding everything in the elementary full prototype was about $600 million. We knew we didn't have $600 million. So in working with both a consultant to the commission and then the five educator members of the commission, we asked them to review, and if you remember yesterday, your yellow sheet with all the details of the prototypes, and asked what were the most critical components of that elementary prototype that they believe were necessary in order to reach that target. If you were a baseline school, which again, this is the average, knowing schools, different schools are look differently, but the average statewide, if you looked like the baseline, which are the components that are most important? And they, one of the things all of them said is recognize it's not one thing that will hit that target, it's a combination. And so there are two examples that, in working with them, that were outlined. And both examples have kind of three of the components are similar, and then the last are somewhat different. First of all, fully fund the amount that's included in the full prototype, the full QEM, for textbooks, materials, and equipment. This is an area for many schools that really has suffered over the years. Teachers have been making do with minimal amounts of materials, and the educators felt this could really have an immediate effect, especially in reading and also, but also in math, and to be able to purchase materials that may fit students with different learning styles as well. Focus time for those students who aren't meeting standards. After school programs, tutoring, those types of programs. More time is important, but especially if it's focused for those who are having difficulty, and a variety of strategies were used. They recommend it include that. Professional development. If the workforce, who are the ones who are teaching our children and leading our teachers, do not have skills and the up-to-date skills to deal with the challenging expectations that we're setting and the variety of students we now have in our schools, they're not going to be able to do a high-quality job. And so the recommendation was fund the full amount of professional development that had been included in the full prototype for elementary schools. In the first example, then, also, they suggested a reading specialist. As you may have seen, in the baseline, there are 2.2 FTE specialists. They recommended going in the full prototype, going to 4.5. to add specialists for a number of areas. They said if you took one of those specialists and had them focus on reading, not for a pull-out program especially, but to help diagnose, to look at test scores, to help teachers identify the kinds of reading strategies that will work with individual students, that could have an immediate payoff. They also suggested in the full prototype, they had recommended a half-time instructional improvement person, staff person, to help analyze the test data, help teachers understand how to realign their programs, allow time for the teachers to work with each other to really focus. I think some of the discussion you heard yesterday from two of the commissioners talked about the need to really look, not just to look at the overall test data for the school, but for students. What does this tell you about what individual students may need? So if you take those additional costs then for those components, I'm still under example one, and you look at the cost over the baseline for 2 years, you add all of these up at the school level, you multiply it times the 80 MW in elementary, then the total statewide cost is about $220 million over the baseline. The other example, in working with the consultant and the commissioners, they suggested, again, the first three items, the textbooks, more time for students, that means standards and professional development. But in lieu of the reading specialist and the half-time instructional improvement staff, you could actually do the class size reduction that had been recommended in the K-3 from an average of 24 to an average of 20. Now, this will take longer because you have time to hire staff to enculturate them into their schools. And I think the other point that certainly researchers say over and over again, class size by itself doesn't make the difference. It's class size combined with instructional strategies, the professional development.
Excuse me, Jean. Mm-hmm. Example, two assumptions up there now, statewide cost over baseline, mm-hmm. $220 million. And that assumes that nothing was done on example one assumption. The reason I asked, that's $220 million also. Mm-hmm.
Yes, there are two separate examples, okay. But they're just trying, again, because we're not mandating, what we're trying to say are there's some different ways to get at this target. This one also, now what this one does not cover are the additional facilities costs, and we talked about that earlier. Capital costs were outside the work of the Quality Education Commission and have been a local responsibility. So if you're going to reduce class size and you don't have the classroom space, there would be the need also locally for them to pass a bond to do that. So either one of these examples then provide us with some sense of what it might take. Now, it's not a mandate. And I think that Yvonne Curtis yesterday showed at her particular school, she'd do some of these, do pieces of some of these, do some other things. Her class size is already low. She'd focus more on the all-day kindergarten. I think Elaine Taylor had mentioned having a whole sheet of how she would utilize the funds in her elementary schools, and it includes a number of these components, but includes things like $3,000 for parent education to support reading, a number of other strategies to really focus on students not meeting standards, additional professional development, more focus perhaps on some of the newer teachers. So again, it's not a mandate, but it allows us to look at if we would expect 90% of third and fifth graders to meet or exceed reading benchmarks within 4 years, what do we think it might cost? A reasonable estimate of the cost at a statewide level. $220 million over baseline. Now, we still didn't have $220 million as the governor was trying to balance. So just as he has done in other parts of the budget, which was to say, how can we reprioritize? Can we shift some funds around? Prior to final development of the budget, he sat down with the leadership of the education organizations and said, how about if we, in essence, match it? That we'll put $110 million of new money, in this case tobacco settlement money, in, but it would also require shifting of $110 million of current resources. And given, I'm sure no one really liked that idea, but given the budget situation we're in, it appeared to be a proposal that was acceptable, if not preferable. So we then used the budget to say, I mean, the easy way to say it is, schools, you eat $110 million. But as I noted, what the quality ed model allows us to do is to say, what does that mean? If we were to require that schools had to reallocate their share of $110 million from the middle school and high school level, what kinds of impacts might there be? Now, there could be, given all these details, there you could parcel it out in little bits here and there, and I'm sure that's probably what most districts will do. But to, again, provide policymakers with some sense of what that might mean, $110 million might mean having to increase class size in middle and high schools from 24 to 25. It might mean having to eliminate the counselors that are there. It might mean also cutting back on a number of these other areas, but the model allows us to look at that. Now, part of the governor's budget strategy also involves some budget packages that you heard about in the Department of Education's budget that really focuses primarily on middle school and high school in a more targeted way, especially dropout prevention package and assistance to low-performing schools. So as part of thinking about if school districts would have to reallocate, are there some ways, more focused ways, that there can be some assistance so we're not feeling the full brunt of that reallocation? So then, and when we come to that, then we look at what are the performance expectations under the governor's budget. We've heard about the 90% of the third and fifth graders meeting the benchmarks, reading benchmarks within 4 years. At the same time, it was felt that significant progress could be made on third and fifth grade in math. If you're focusing on younger children, it may not be, I mean, just having that focus may also help math to come along. Probably not to the 90%, but we should be able to see significant progress there. And then lastly, as far as 8th and 10th graders, that there would be continued progress, but if you recall the charts yesterday, and actually if you have your ballot measure 1 report there, a ways back, there are some charts that show performance expectations under current resource levels and under the full OQEM. So for 8th and 10th grade, even under current resource levels, there had been an expectation that there would still be some growth. So we would expect under this budget to still see some growth, but probably not to the levels that would have been expected under the current resource levels. So that sets then the performance expectations for the governor's budget. Next we can see that the first part of this you saw yesterday, the state school fund amount, 9901, the CSL, the full quality ed model would have been $6.061 billion, and the governor's recommended it's $5.199. There's 15 million of other pieces that we can talk about at a later time. So then we go back to the findings under Measure 1. Measure 1 requires the legislature to publish a report. The governor thought, well, in fact, I remember leadership saying, Governor, you put this all on us. And he said, oh, don't worry, I'll do it first. I'll be the first one that has to show you that. And actually, under House Bill 2295, that is also up for work session tomorrow on House Ed and will be coming to you, which implements Measure 1 by using the quality ed model, he is proposing that governors be required to issue this report. And so he did issue this report. It's up on the web. It was sent out as part of the budget. So the questions that have to be addressed, is the money sufficient to ensure the state system meets quality goals established by law? The answer is no, it is not. Why is it? What's the reason for the insufficiency? Revenues available under current law can't support continuation of current programs across state government. We've seen program reductions. You're seeing program reductions throughout state government. At the same time, funding for K-12 has been increased in order to focus on the priority performance targets. What's the extent of the insufficiency? $862 million. It's the difference between the full quality ed model and the amount in the governor's budget. But the part that I think is most powerful, what's the impact of the insufficiency? And Measure 1 didn't just say, you have enough? No. Why not? We don't have enough money. It said, describe that. How can we understand? Again, it's trying to be more explicit about what we're doing in terms of decision-making at the state level. And that is, student performance is expected to increase, as you note in the performance targets, but not to the levels expected under the full quality ed model. Attachment B on the report actually then shows, using these examples compared with the baseline schools and the full quality ed model, where does the governor's budget lie? So you can see the two examples for increases at the elementary school with plenty of asterisks stating these are just examples. Schools don't have to do it this way. And then you can see at the middle school and the high school levels the impact going the other way of actually reallocating, again, noting school districts will need to make the decisions and that these are just given as examples. So Measure 1 and the Quality Ed Model then at the state level provides a way to establish some expectations in relationship to the dollars that are appropriated by state policymakers. So how do we then hold the schools accountable for that? The School Improvement Fund is the bill that I would say is the hook into this. The bill, in essence, in the appropriations bill, the full $220 million is appropriated to the School Improvement Fund. What the bill, and when you get it, we'll go through this in more detail when you have a hearing on it, but it links school funding to expected performance under the approved budget. It's not competitive. Schools, districts are eligible to receive the money basically on a formula basis. It allows districts a flexibility to determine the best ways to meet those goals. There are a menu of items, class size reduction, professional development materials, many of the things you see on here that schools can select some from. But before accessing their share of the money, they'll be required to submit a plan. And I think that Kate Dixon can talk to you more about this. The expectation is it would be a simple plan. I think Elaine Taylor has hers on one page from McMinnville School District, which says, how would you plan on utilizing those funds? And then what are your targets for performance, improvements in student performance? And initially, the temporary clause is focused on third and fifth grade. In addition, and we're having amendments have been drafted to deal with this, but Representative Barnhart pointed out to us we didn't have it in the bill. For those districts that are already on the path to meeting those benchmarks, they'll have flexibility to focus on other ways. Now, I know I've had superintendents say to me, we've already moved money to the elementary school. Do we need to do more? But the question is the performance there? That's really the focus, is the performance there. Lastly, it requires the Department of Education to include this information of the school district plans and the targets for performance and their accountability system, and then to report to the legislature on the progress that school districts are making in meeting the established targets. And from there, I'm assuming Kate Dixon is sitting behind me somewhere.
She hasn't left yet.
Kate,
please.
She can come up and start talking about the accountability system in the Department of Education.
Thank you, Jean. That's a very nice report, good report. Kate, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator Hartung. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Good.
I've enjoyed this conversation about the quality ed model and what it will do in helping us understand the funding for our schools as well as setting some quality targets for student learning. For the record, I'm Kate Dixon, and my role in today's presentation is to bring us a description to the accountability aspect of the quality ed model and the funding for the targeted goals. One of the questions, as was presented earlier when Duncan was finalizing the presentation, was that one area that the Quality Ed Model Commission did not address this year, partially because it was not within their scope of work, was what about the accountability? And it's hard to create a model such as the Quality Ed Model and not have that question surface almost immediately. And so how are people going to be held accountable? And what we're passing out currently is a proposal about accountability. But one of the things I wanted to do just for a couple of minutes in the buff-colored handout that you're receiving is to provide just a short context for accountability in schools and in education. And for me, it's a little bit of a century at a glance instead of a 10-year glance. And I think it's as we go through and try to develop an accountability process, and now you'll see the teacher in me as well, we need to understand the context with which we create our models and our work. And one of the things that I want to just kind of review is that from about 1900 to 1960, We created a process around education, all the way from how do we create schooling opportunities to enhance the mental discipline and prepare our young people for work. And we had people like John Dewey influencing our world of education and creating classrooms where basic principles of community living were developed. We had Frederick Taylor. Many of you are familiar with his work around the manufacturing model and also doing creating schools that were based on sort of the factory model in preparing our young people to work. And then we moved into the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And depending on how old you are, you'll remember some of these reforms. You may have experienced them yourself. In the 60s, we moved very quickly to an attitude of focusing on what we might call the parts. We had Sputnik in 1957, and I happened to be in elementary school at the time, and I won't tell you how old I was, but I do recall Sputnik, and then I do recall the following year I had a new math textbook. And we also moved science into our curriculum, and one of the things that happened based on that era of the 60s was that we began to really look at subject matter and curriculum, and we upgraded the quality of our curriculum, particularly in science and mathematics, and that was a wave not only nationally but in Oregon. Then we moved into the 70s, and we began to worry a little bit that perhaps it was more than just curriculum that made a difference in how children learned and how we made a difference in the work that and how well prepared our students were. And we're also rebounding from the notion that there were classrooms were becoming a little bit more child-centered and open. And the refrain from that in the 70s was a back-to-basics movement. And some of you may remember that with your own children or yourselves as well, where there was a much stronger emphasis on the teaching of reading, writing, and arithmetic. And at the same time, we also began to focus on staff development, particularly for teachers around instructional behaviors. And then as we moved into the 80s, we had another national report, and at this time we had a national report called A Nation at Risk, which talked about a rising tide of mediocrity. And a year later, we had another book that came out that influenced education a great deal, which was called In Search of Excellence. And we took both of those movements around A Nation at Risk and In Search of Excellence. And in 1984, the state board adopted the Oregon Action Plan for Excellence and began to define common curriculum goals, assess students, and involve communities in education. And from that, at that point, we created House Bill 2020, which some of you may remember, school improvement grants. We began to form site councils, and many schools and districts were involved in strategic planning and school improvement planning. By 1990, we said we need to continue to do more, and we need to continue to assure our schools are getting better, and our students need to be the best educated and the best prepared for the workforce. And so in 1991, we passed the Oregon Act for the 21st Century, the Oregon Education Act. And that really was a major shift in how we held ourselves accountable, our schools accountable, and our students accountable for learning. And it really began to shift to a proficiency-based system using standards and began to measure student success by proficiency. And that's really where we are today, except we're about 9 to 10 years into this movement, where we're saying we are going to judge the quality of our schools based on what our students know and are able to do. And so that's really where we are with our focus on a statewide accountability system, is how can we be assured that our students are capable and have the proficiencies that they need to be successful in the 21st century. And so at this point, I'd like to begin to describe to you the beginning of our work around what we're calling an Oregon Educational Accountability System, because this is a question that has come up repeatedly over the last year, and it's been a question that came up long before this past year. But in doing so, I wanted to give a context that this isn't an empty glass, if you will. The glass is about half full around what accountability is for our schools, but we can continue to refine our effort. In the handout on the white paper, you see a graphic that basically shows what we believe one of the things that we need to have for accountability, and that is that it is a distributed sense of accountability. And Gene just described Measure 1, which identifies a new accountability measure that we've just enacted in this state, which is a way for the legislature and the governor to have a sense of accountability. But we also obviously have school accountability. We have student accountability. There should be a state board and Oregon Department of Education accountability. Our local communities and our local citizens need to also share in this accountability. This is a work in progress, and as I walk through it, I'm going to move very quickly because I know your time is short, and there will be another time to describe this in more detail. But I want to give you kind of a framework for how to think, how to understand what the thinking is about this. We believe that we need to provide leadership for responsibility and continuous improvement. And this accountability system has three core areas. We believe that accountability drives continuous academic improvement. We believe that accountability ensures responsible action, and that it also identifies excellence. And if you're looking for where I am, I'm on page one of the handout with this little graphic in front of it. We also have some guiding principles that we've identified as the core of what we believe an effective accountability system is. We believe that an accountability system needs to be based on research-based educational principles. We've also based this accountability system in guiding principles upon the goals of the Oregon Education Act for the 21st century, the vision themes of the education leadership team, and the goals of the quality ed model. And those begin to be a commitment to personal and academic success and improvement of each student in Oregon, a belief that strong leadership and rigorous staff development is essential to building capacity, that responsibility for student success is shared by all Oregonians and must be identified and supported throughout the system, that incentives, targeted assistance, and consequences are to be used in a fair and predictable manner. And community engagement and support are critical to ensure responsible action for both student and school success, and that the system should identify excellence as it should measure progress with a variety of specific success indicators. So the rest of this document on page 2 just kind of moves through what we think some of those core areas are. If accountability is to drive continuous academic improvement and success, one of the first areas of agreement we need to have is accountability is linked to student performance. And that is really where we link this with the quality ed model, that the accountability for success is linked to our students learning more and doing better. The focus is on the district and on the school as units of improvement, and it builds on support and progress for students. We will ensure responsible action by using a process of incentives, assistance, and consequences in this accountability system. And that we do believe that one of the best ways for schools and students to do better is to by identifying excellence. That one of the areas where the way we learn and the way we know that we can improve is by seeing models of where it's working and then moving into those areas for further review. What I'd like to do in page 4 of this white document is also to share with you that we are, again, not starting with an empty glass. Our glass is at least half full. We have a number of statutes already identified that begin to create what I would call a full accountability system. We have the ORSs for high standards and core academic areas. We have the ORSs that provide for statewide and school-based assessment measures that align to standards. We have the school and district report cards. We have accountability standards for continuous improvement with our consolidated district improvement planning requirement, and we have requirements for compliance of state and federal law. So that one of the things that happens when people say, what's the accountability, I want people to understand that the state has been very responsible in creating accountability measures along the way. Where I'd like to take your attention now is page 6 of this document, and it's it's a buff-colored piece that's attached to this document. It's page 6 of 7, and it talks about the Oregon Education Accountability System applied to the quality education model, because that has been the core question. If the opportunity is here for to set these target goals, what happens when a school does not reach these goals? There's the bottom line question, and a number of people have been asking that. And so what I'd like to do is ask you to turn to page 7 of this document, where it begins to build a matrix. And you'll see on the left-hand side of the matrix, year 1, year 2, year 3, year 4, and year 5. As you recall, Gene's presentation just a few minutes ago, that these quality goals of 90% of our children in grades 3 through 5 reading at the 90% grade level, we are to accomplish that by 2004. So we've set a continuum for accountability that begins in year 1. The first thing is we'll not wait until year 4 to do something about our work with the schools. And in year 1, and if you'll read across the top portion from left to right, you'll see level of performance around support and assistance. In the school districts that students are 90 to 100% of the students meeting benchmarks in reading at the third and fifth grade level, that would be the column that they would look. There's some ongoing support and assistance that would be there upon their request, opportunities for professional development, and there would be the continuous reporting of report cards. In the middle column, under support and targeted assistance, you'll notice where it reads 60 to 89% of the students meeting benchmarks or making improvement. And what you'll see, again, year 1, we would be assuming that schools are moving in the direction that they are intending to move, that they're making progress. If they're not, they can request technical assistance, or we may we'd be able to contact those schools as well. If a school gets into year 2 and they still are in that range, less than 60% of their students meeting the benchmarks, we would begin to require a district to review and revise their school improvement plans and pay attention to it. And if we get into year 3 and the school is still in this range, then you can see that we will not only require the district to conduct an assessment of district and school reading performance, but they'll have to use a particular set of tools that we've developed around the quality indicators in the quality ed model. And then if they get to year 4, you can see that not only will they be required to do an assessment, but there will be an opportunity for them to work directly with a consultant and to revise their district and school improvement plans. Then the third column is for the schools that less than 60% of their students are meeting benchmarks. And again, you can see year 1, year 2, year 3, and year 4. And the shaded areas on this matrix are the areas that currently are not in either statute or rule. And in most cases, the State Board of Education, whom we reviewed this last week with, all of these gray areas except for one can be administered through an administrative rule. There's one option in the fourth year that would require a change in statute, and that option is to require districts to allow choice to transfer a student to another public school. And you've heard some of those kinds of suggestions before, and that one is probably one of the more controversial suggestions we have on the page.
Chair Hartung?
Yes.
Can I ask Kate a question?
Certainly.
Can you tell me what the factors are or what the discussion was to wait until the fourth year on your options with those schools that are less than 60%?
Chair Hartung, Representative Winters, yes. What we really see ourselves doing is that we were wanting to provide some continuous support for the schools to improve, but obviously if they get to year four and have not improved, we need to give the students and their parents some additional choices.
Because I'm thinking if you've had 4 years with which to go beyond that mm-hmm. percent mark, and we're talking about those students who by now are beginning to get into mm-hmm. you know, eighth and ninth grade or whatever, those grades, that one of our dilemmas that we've all have been discussing in this building of how do we work with the students at the most earlier formative years so that we're talking that they have the skills. And to me, I don't know, I just looked at the delay factor, and I would, you know, not want to be a parent or a student who was at one of those schools that are still well below the 60% mark. And so I would just kind of would like to have some thought on why we waited 4 years of this group, and historically it's usually those schools who don't have the same kind of resources. So are there the poverty schools, are there the schools in inner schools that both the chair and I are very, very concerned of, but the community that we came from several years ago. So I'd just like to have more discussion of why it takes 4 years for the hammer hits.
Yeah, Kate, maybe we can get back to that. I do need to complete your part of it by 2:30,
okay.
But I would like to have a discussion about what the representative just said, because that is very much in our mind.
Senator Hartung, Representative Winters, we would be happy to have that conversation, and you do notice draft, mm-hmm. and that is a very important part of our conversation, what the kind of the timing of this effort.
Okay, thank you.
I conclude my remarks, Senator Hartung.
You have. Thank you. Let's see, Nancy, are you going to report to us, or we have your printed material, it looks like, between you and Duncan? Can we just read it, or do you want to tell us something about it?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Nancy Heiligman from the Department of Education. We simply provided those written materials in response to your questions. So if you have any further questions, we'd be happy.
Right. You heard what I just said to Kate, and I wish you would collaborate with her, too, on this accountability feedback from the QEM. I tell you, there's so much more information here than we've ever had before when we're trying to develop a budget, but it's all good information, but we need to spend a little more time on it.
Thank you,
okay.
Mr. Chair. I would like to comment that the accountability framework is very much a work in progress. This is a first draft, and we really welcome feedback from policymakers to help improve the system.
Okay, well, that's good. Yes, Senator Trow.
I'm hoping that that we're looking more broadly than just at accountability for reading performance targets, because we have a growing need. And Senator Gordley, I think, has done a good job of pointing out what's a growing education deficit that a number of our students have, and all is related to reading, no question about that. It's not just reading, and that's growing, and it's growing in certain areas of the state and certain situations more than others. And are we at the State Department looking at that, and will there be special help and special programs at some point to help with that?
Senator Hartung and Senator Trow, yes, we are looking at that, and we have been working with Senator Gordley, as a matter of fact, quite closely. And just a couple of things I can't resist saying. Our policy option package on dropout prevention in low-performing schools is aimed at targeting at those exact issues, and we are working to provide for that closing the achievement gap and understanding how we can better understand student performance by disaggregating the data, whether it's by ethnicity or other factors. And so, yes.
Growing today.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, and we will be hearing from you again. Let's see, we have several school board members from Ashland here, is that correct?
Yeah.
We do, if you'd please come forward, well, I appreciate it. We'd like to hear from you. Sorry that you, well, I'm not sorry now that you are going to be able to speak, but I'm glad you're here. Please identify yourself and proceed.
Senator Hartung, thank you for listening to us. We appreciate it. My name is Amy Amrine. I am a school board member-elect from Ashland. I'll be taking my seat in July.
Well, my name is Chuck Kyle. I'm also a parent in Ashland, a third grader, a small business owner, and also elected to the school board.
Thank you.
We've come to Salem for the past two sessions now to testify and rally with friends and neighbors for adequate public school funding. We've begged and pleaded with our legislators to allocate sufficient funds so all Oregon school districts can maintain no-cuts budgets. Last session was disheartening because we felt the money was available, but the legislature did not adequately fund schools. This year is disheartening because the money is not there, and the original $5.2 billion figure we felt would be adequate has turned out to be woefully inadequate. There are many reasons for the increased cost in K-12 education. This year, Ashland has budgeted a 35% increase in energy costs alone. You know and probably understand many of the issues involved in funding education. We've been listening to the presentations on the QEM and from the ODE. They seem quite adequate and important from my point of view. But the penalties to our children are immeasurable when year after year we fall short of our generational commitment to adequately fund the public schools. This year in Ashland, we face an $840,000 shortfall in balancing our budget. Our reserves, which gradually have been spent down during the past 10 years, are now depleted. We have been fortunate to enjoy local tax support with our youth activities levy, which was renewed with 70% approval last May for another 3 years. However, the cost of a well-rounded education at the level we deem minimally acceptable continues to outpace our state and local revenues. This year, Ashland Public Schools will lose 14 staff positions. That's teachers, administrators, and classified personnel, which means increased class sizes and fewer programs. Deferred maintenance will continue to be neglected. Important programs such as second languages in the middle schools were eliminated years ago. What is equally discouraging to us is trying to find where to take the cuts this year is that we are facing the frightening forecast that the next biennium's revenue estimates are dismal. We see no hope for reinstating lost programs and are panicking that the Oregon public school system is being forced toward mediocrity. I urge you to support the quality education model as a tool that links funding with the quality education goals established in law, and I also ask that you fund the K-12 education at the $5.2 billion proposed figure. Any less will mean further class size increases, more deferred maintenance of old school buildings, loss of essential programs for all students, and the continued 10-year erosion of Oregon's excellent public school system. Thank you.
Thank you, Amy. Yes, sir?
Chair Hartung, Senator Trow, representatives, thank you very much for taking the time to hear us today. You have heard, and you will be hearing, a very sad litany of educational funding.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Oh, for the record, my name is Chuck Kyle.
Okay.
From Ashland.
Thank you.
You have heard and will be hearing a sad litany of educational funding shortages throughout Oregon today. This inadequacy is felt across the board throughout the state, not only in K-12 education, but in services to elders, children, higher education, and public safety. Ashland has been fortunate in many ways during the past decade. After initial cuts in educational services, the community found a way to raise additional money to make up some of the shortfall. State funding. The source of this additional revenue for the schools is a tax levied on City of Ashland property owners by the voters. This youth activity levy has now been passed 3 times by voters with significant majorities. How is it possible for voters in Oregon to pass increased taxes on themselves during this decade of the tax revolution? I do not accept any contention the residents of Ashland are somehow different. I'm a small business owner. I certainly hate to pay taxes as much as anybody else, and I'm certainly not a wealthy person. Yet I voted for that levy, and the last time, under Amy's leadership, worked to help pass it. So how does that happen? I believe there is one thing that can distinguish Ashland, the Ashland community. Our political and community leaders have been willing to stand up and tell voters the truth about money. What our leadership has said is that in order to have uncrowded schools, excellent public libraries, adequate public safety, it is up to the voters to provide the money. Our former mayor, Kathy Shaw, asked for bond money for a new library and a new fire station. Our current mayor, Alan DeBoer, as a school board member, asked voters for a bond to expand the middle school, to renovate the high school, and provide other facilities. My colleague, Amy Amrine, asked the voters to significantly increase the youth activities levy. The voters responded positively to this political leadership. Not every bond or levy passes in Ashland. The voters want to hear their leaders stand up and explain what the money is to be used for and why it's needed. When the explanation is reasonable and the need is well defined, the voters will approve the necessary funding. So what is different then? I believe that the difference is courage. Elected officials and other community leaders need to have courage to stand up before any group and make the case for increased revenue. What I'm asking for from this committee is political courage, the courage to stand up and tell the voters what the needs are, why additional revenue is necessary, and why, if it's necessary, for instance, you would keep the kicker in Salem to provide adequate services across the state. Thank you all very much for your time.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful, and hope to hear from you after we get our forecast and it's a little more clear what our resources will be. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is Ron Nassel here? Yeah. Hi, Ron. Is there anyone else that's come from 100 miles away that thought there was going to be a public hearing today? Okay, that's fine. We've got time, Ron, and welcome. And George Russell, we'd like to hear from you on whatever you want to say when Ron is done here.
Okay. Chairman Hartung, members of the committee, my name is Ron Naso. I come before you today in two capacities, as the superintendent of the North Clackamas School District, and as the co-chair of the OASE School Funding Coalition Steering Committee. For well over a year now, the school superintendents of this state, through this coalition steering committee, have been working together to reach consensus around school funding proposals, which will allow the schools of this state to continue to provide an adequate educational program. The coalition steering committee is not unlike the state legislature. It has representatives from among the smallest districts in the state, from suburban and mid-sized districts, from the urban centers of Portland and Salem. As you might know, consensus has not been easy. We have, however, reached a consensus on a number of issues. We have consensus that the $5.214 billion funding proposal put forth by the governor is not sufficient to prevent schools across this state from having to reduce existing programs. We have consensus that the $5.214 billion funding proposal is the best that we can expect from this legislative session, given the variety of constraints which this legislature faces. We have consensus that we will take steps to implement the quality education model, a model which gives operational structure to the vision originally outlined in school reform legislation that was passed a decade ago. And finally, we have consensus that the $5.214 billion funding proposal should not and cannot be reduced if we are to have a chance of maintaining a school system at any level of adequacy. Because of this consensus, I am here today to ask this committee to remain firm in supporting the full funding of the $5.214 billion budget for K-12 education. That support must stand firm in the face of attempts to find money for other programs by crafting accounting arguments which would claim that the schools don't really need all the money calculated in the current service level roll-up. That support must stand firm in the face of attempts to find money for other programs by using increases in federal funding, which are categorical monies, to offset the need for state funding. As the superintendent of the North Clackamas School District, a district which has had long, which has long taken pride in its schools, and a district which has worked hard to implement the school reform legislation of this state. I'm currently meeting with my budget committee to find over $2 million in program reductions for the coming year. Senator Hartung, you mentioned that you're dealing with a 2010-5 situation. I know that all of you represent districts. You also represent all of us in the state, so add two to that piece. And I want to leave one...
2010-5-2.
Right, and I'd like to add one other number, 60,000. Okay, and I'll tell you about that one in just a second. Based on the information that we have about the $5.2 billion education budget, we're anticipating an increase in revenue for next year of $4.3 million. That's not an inconsequential figure. In percentage terms, this is a 4.6% increase. All things being equal, that's a reasonable increase. Why the problem? Well, let's start with where the revenue comes from. Approximately $2 million of that money is directly related to increase in ADMW of 350 students. We're expecting more students that we have to have classroom space for, that we have to have books, teachers, etc. In truth, if we did not have that growth, our revenue would increase by $2.3 million or 2.5%. Put that against the following numbers. Health insurance, 24% increase. $1.8 million real dollars from last year to this year. Energy and utilities, 30% increase, $500,000 real dollars from last year, from this year to next year. Personnel salary increases, if we're able to get there, 2%, $1.5 million after attrition, for those who think we sometimes try to cook the books by not counting that. After attrition, $1.5 million. Special education tuition increases, $500,000. ELL and special ed expansion, $500,000. I mention the latter because our increase of 350 students is an ADMW increase, not a headcount increase. Most of the, I shouldn't say most, but a good portion of the increase that we're going to see is going to come from students who get waiting. ELL students, special education students, who also bring with them an incredible need for services that go far beyond that waiting process. With some real struggle, we're going to be able to balance our budget, but only because we will receive additional revenues from that growth. All around this state, there are districts whose enrollments are only slightly higher, are exactly the same, or God help them, in decline. Those districts, a majority of the districts in this state, cannot absorb any additional reductions in the $5.214 billion education budget, which is currently in play. On their behalf, I urge you, as a committee, to stand firm in support of this budget without cuts and without transfer mechanisms which would give the appearance of standing firm while actually reducing needed revenues in our schools. I mentioned to remember $60,000. When you hear Portland cutting $20 million, Beaverton $10 million, Hillsboro $5 million, North Clackamas $2 million, and I'm sure other people will have those stories, the $60 million and maybe it's $75 million, I don't really know the number, is the number that Colton has to cut. Most of us would probably sit here and say, $60,000, $75,000, what's that? That's a fortune. And I think we have to remember the proportionality of the cuts that are going on in this state. Because I know what Colton, a small school district in my county, has had to do because of a $60,000 to $75,000 cut, which for them, which for all of us, is 15 students. 15 students plays havoc. So I would hope that all of us would understand the challenges we have and that we would hold firm to the budget that we have, knowing that we're not going to get any more. We just pray we get no less.
Good. Thank you, Ron. That's a great testimony. What's the enrollment in the North Clackamas School District?
North Clackamas School District is about 15,000 headcount and about 17,200 ADMW.
the largest district in the state?
No. We're, I think, number six.
Portland would be, yeah.
Yeah, we're number six in the
Portland
state.
Portland and Salem-Keizer and Indiana. Yeah. Okay, and thank you very much. We have your written, and I know you'll keep track of us through Ozzie Rose, so, yeah, thank you for coming. George Russell, please. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Chair Hartung and honorable members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education, thank you so much for at least allowing us a few minutes. I'm not going to take a lot of time. We have with us Beth Giroux, who's the vice chair of our Board of Education, and she's going to make some statements to you. Just as an introduction, let me just say that I've been the school district superintendent in Eugene for about 3 years now. And each of those 3 years, I've been faced with the situation of dealing with budget reductions as opposed to trying to add new programs and do better things for our children. The first year I was superintendent, we closed an elementary school on the south side of Eugene. This year, we're looking at closing, for next year, two additional elementary schools. And as we talk about the kinds of cuts and the pain that is created in a community that, in fact, passed a local option several years ago, it is very difficult to sometimes explain to them how they could pass a local option providing us with about $5 million additional each year for our school budget and stand up and talk to them about why we're closing schools, cutting middle school athletics, laying off teachers. So with that kind of introduction, I'm going to ask Beth Giroux to go through the statement that our board president and vice chair have prepared.
Thank you, George. And Beth, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you. Chair Hartung and honorable members of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Education, I'm going to be talking a little bit about what's happening in our district now, next year, but I also want to touch on what's happened over the last decade. The Eugene School Board strongly supports the governor's $5.2 billion funding proposal for K-12 education. Eugene School District, like many districts, both large and small across the state, must make cuts again next year, even if the governor's proposed K-12 appropriation is approved. While we are deeply concerned over further reductions and the impact on our students, we recognize the state's financial situation. We believe Governor Kitzhaber's revised budget balancing strategy is a reasonable approach in light of the state's revenue forecast for the next biennium. Over the past 10 years, K-12 funding has not kept pace with inflation or with our actual costs. Still, we are proud of our results, helping students meet and surpass state benchmarks, building career-related learning programs, and reducing the dropout rate. Current service level means cuts to 4J. The Eugene School District will cut $3.1 million to balance our budget next year, another number to add, and possibly an additional $700,000 in 2002-2003, even if K-12 funding is approved at the $5.2 billion level. Class sizes will be bigger. Two elementary schools will be closed, as the superintendent suggested. There will be fewer electives for high school students. Music, PE, health, and TAG programs will be further reduced. These cuts are required even though Eugene School District voters passed a local option levy, which generates over $5 million annually to support operations. Furthermore, these reductions do not reflect that we are failing to adequately maintain our buildings. Our district should be spending about $9 million per year on building system upgrades and building replacements, $1 million on building preservation, and at least $2 million on equipment acquisition and replacement. Currently, only $500,000 in ongoing funding is available to address these needs. Many of the costs of educating our children exceed the overall rate of inflation. While salaries in our district have stayed within state cost of living adjustments, other major expenses have not. Special education costs are escalating. Next year, we will spend $500,000 more than our inflationary adjustment. Natural gas prices, have increased 24% this year. Electricity prices are expected to increase 50 to 100% next year. Diesel fuel costs have increased over 70%. We also must move expenses for facility maintenance and other capital costs into our general fund. These costs can no longer be paid with general obligation bonds and were covered last biennium with state lottery bonds. And we must restore our reserves, which is especially prudent during this time of financial uncertainty. The recent news from Oregon Department of Education announcing a shortfall in local revenues and delaying a final payment for 2000-2001 underscores the importance of adequate financial reserve to meet district cash flow needs. Since the passage of Measure 5, the Eugene School District has made severe cuts that have meant the loss of a truly excellent and well-rounded educational program. Over the last decade, we have increased class size by 12%, cut PE teachers by 32%, cut librarians by 55%, cut counselors by 54%, reduced or eliminated elective programs, increased participation fees, fundraising, and ticket prices for athletics and other student activities, reduced staff salaries through compensation freezes, and cut central support staff and central administrative FTE by more than 25% since 1988-89. We've made improvements in reading. In Eugene, we have tried to project the elementary classroom to ensure students get off to a strong start. 90% of our third graders meet or surpass state reading benchmarks. 84% of our fifth graders meet or surpass state reading benchmarks. We have made deliberate decisions to cut at the middle school and high school level in order to preserve our elementary school program. As a result, high school students have classes of 35 to 45 students. Today, North Eugene High School has 15 more students than a decade ago and 25 fewer teachers. That translates into fewer electives, less individual attention, and fewer choices and experiences for students. We support the governor's focus on reading improvement. In Eugene, the school improvement funds would allow us to continue our successful reading initiatives. While we are cutting our services at all school levels next year, these programs would suffer even more if the governor's school improvement funds are not available to us. Special education costs are another area that we're very concerned about. We are concerned that the legislature may supplant federal IDEA and other grant funding. Because our special education enrollment exceeds 11%, we serve substantially more students than the state funding formula supports. Our funding gap is increasing. While district enrollment has declined, special education enrollment has increased. We are spending about 12% more than the revenue we currently receive for required special ed programs. We have a higher than average number of high-cost students in the district, particularly students with autism. In 1999-2000, costs for 88 special ed students exceeded $20,000 per student. For 20 students, costs exceeded $30,000. Our local ESD has capped enrollment in its special education classes, forcing the district to provide those services at a much greater cost, a total of about $22,000 per student. Oregon school districts need these federal funds to meet the needs of our special education students. Our schools deserve stability and adequate funding. We hope that you will make K-12 funding your top priority by appropriating $5.2 billion for K-12 education as proposed in the governor's budget. And I'd like to just direct your attention to the two pieces. I'm not going to go through them, but you may read them at your leisure. The first sheet in the packet is 4J budget cuts that we will be making 2001-2002 and gives you an idea of the kinds of things in addition to the ones that I mentioned today. And the second piece gives you a decade of the reductions that we have made in 4J, an overview of all those kinds of cuts that we have made. And on the back, we've put together, on the very back of your packet, kind of an overview of K-12 funding in Oregon over the last decade, showing the shift in funding from local funding to state funding, the enrollment growth And the operating revenue, and I think it's particularly telling if you look at the line that shows that the percent of revenue growth in K-12 since 1990-91 has been 18%. Inflation growth over that same period of time has been 32%. So K-12 funding has not kept up with inflation growth. And the bottom line, K-12 resources as a percent of Oregon personal income in 1990-91 was 4.1%. In 1999-2000, it was 3.5%. So individuals in our state are actually spending less of their personal income on education than they were a decade ago. And then finally, if you would note that the chart at the bottom, which shows that we are spending about $550 per student less today in real dollars than we were in 1992-93. Significant losses in our district over the last decade. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Beth and George. This is excellent information, and we'll be in touch with you before we get a budget developed, I'm sure. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question because of this excellent information.
Yes.
And what jumps out at me was there already their reading improvement, and your 90% of your third graders who meet already surpassed, and 84% of your fifth graders who meet are surpassed. And that within a very tight, or as you're saying, budgetary cuts that you did. And I just want to commend you of your achievements. You don't very often get individuals that come before us and say that they've done all these things and we're still able to have that kind of success.
And I would have to say that I have to congratulate our board on taking a strong position, of which Representative Barnhart was a member of that board, that literacy and reading at the elementary levels was going to be a strong priority, and that they would reduce class sizes in K through 3 in order to help move us in that direction at the expense of putting dollars elsewhere throughout the district.
I want to commend the good board chair, and he wasn't even on our interim committee on quality and Representative Hobson.
I have a question. Yeah. Go ahead.
Senator.
And I think they did it at some cost because they made other decisions. The class load, class size at the high schools is almost unmanageable, I would think. And if you have dropouts, maybe that helps to explain some of those things. So I know you've done the best you can.
Well, we haven't. I just can't let the dropout piece pass because we do like to boast that we think we have, if not the best, dropout rate, prevention rate in the state, that awfully close to it. Ours is significantly under 4% for all of our high schools.
That's great. Glad to hear that. Despite the
But our class sizes are large, and I would just, and I like to share, because Representative Barnhart was with me, when the governor came down last year, and I believe Beth was with us also, we visited a calculus class in one of our high schools, South Eugene High School, where they had 44 students crowded into a calculus class. So you're correct. We have made some sacrifices.
And I'd like to say that I think that the sacrifices that we're looking at as we move forward are taking a tremendous toll on our staff.
Okay. Thank you very much. The committee is adjourned.